Hi, I'm Steve Ladori.
And I'm Akiva Beebe.
Together, we'll be talking to leading innovation experts from across the world who are going to share how they've been keeping themselves busy during this time of disruption. That is, reinventing themselves, their teams, and their businesses at breakneck speed so that they can be ready for the new normal.
Really excited to have Scott Cooper, who is the president and CEO of Truss Beverages. He's going to tell us all about that. Scott and I actually met when he was the VP of Global Innovation for Molson Coors in Denver, Colorado. And I believe his new assignment, in fact, I know his new assignment, is up outside of Toronto, Canada. Scott's been a world-class member of the great Molson Coors organization for, I believe, 25 years. And I'm really looking forward to his comments and thoughts on being disrupted. Unless you've lived under a rock, COVID aside, the beverage industry, I would say particularly the alcoholic and the beer beverage industry, has been under tremendous disruption for the last 10 years. And so we're going to talk to Scott about that, alternative beverages, things like that. So, Scott, thank you very much for joining us. And if I could ask you just maybe say hello and give us a little bit of a preview of your background, and then we'll kind of dive into what's going on in your world of innovation.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for inviting me to join you. Excited to have a quick discussion. First of all, you've aged me somewhat. I was only with Molson Coors for 12 years, not 25.
Oh, sorry about that.
No worries. And I guess I would just describe my background as kind of largely packaged goods, commercial, a number of different sales and marketing roles. Had the great fortune of kind of being involved with innovation throughout, including early in my career with Unilever on the marketing side. Spent a couple of years with a large grocery chain in Canada called Sobeys, where I led R&D and the private label. We launched about 350 products a year as part of my remit there. And then most recently, leading global innovation for Molson Coors, as you mentioned.
How did you find the transition from, let's say, classic packaged goods, such as you would have had in Unilever, to packaged goods, but with obviously the twist of regulation and distribution issues that you find in the alcoholic beverage industry?
Not materially different. I think I may have just been the times, but I'd say alcohol tends to move a little more quickly. I had the opportunity going from packaged goods to retail, where the pace of innovation is ridiculous. As I mentioned, we were launching a product a day on average. And I found alcoholic beverages somewhere between the kind of more classical CPG like a Unilever and grocery. The regulations, I mean, once you're aware of them, you just figure out how to work around and with them. And it wasn't much of a barrier in the end.
So you had Canada, you had the US, you have international, and Molson Coors is a pretty big conglomerate at this point. Any particular challenges or learnings that you can offer from doing that? We have a lot of listeners who are global, but we have a lot of listeners who are doing a startup themselves and just really in one country with what they do.
Yeah, I can describe it at Molson Coors. We had four operating units at the time that I was there, and we set ourselves a goal of any innovation that we work on a global level. There's still local teams in the various operating units. But to kind of qualify or for us to spend attention at the global level, it had to be an idea that could deliver $50 million in revenue within 3 years. And it had to be relevant in at least two of the business units from a geography perspective. And it was interesting that, the ideas that were relevant across all four business units were somewhat rare. So finding big ideas that would work in two or three is often where we landed, just from a regulations, maturity of the industry, local consumer taste preferences.
I'm hoping you could take us back a little bit to your role as the VP for global innovation. How the heck, what was it like? And to some extent, you're still in the industry, of course. But what was it like being in one of the large multinationals during the explosion of the craft beer craze and getting people to understand, hey, we are being disrupted. I'm not sure if you use that term, but someone from the outside. And what were some of the challenges you'd have from a business standpoint/culture standpoint? And I'm sure Akiva's going to want to ask some leadership leadership questions, but what was it like kind of helping to lead the charge, so to speak?
Yeah, like I'm sure many people have been in roles like these. It was exciting and almost bordering on exhilarating as you kind of look at some of the ideas you're focused on. They can change the world, and that's just incredibly motivating, at least for me. And then at the same time, incredibly frustrating, where you kind of see a clear path, you've got an idea, but just the number of stakeholders to get aligned and even just getting resources, really difficult. If a typical job is kind of a flat line, I would describe this as a job with incredible peaks and incredible valleys emotionally and from an energy perspective.
Over time, were you able to begin building a process? I don't know, not so much in governance, but were you able to get traction and get more and more folks to do it? Or did you feel the battle was never ending?
No, I mean, we definitely made progress and feel really good about what we delivered. I mean, I don't think you can be in these jobs and ever feel completely fulfilled at the end. I mean, there's always undone work or things, you wish you'd been able to move faster or get done. Between kind of the first year and second year in the role, we benchmarked ourselves externally with an organization called the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, which measures companies across a huge range of measures and sustainability from an environmental perspective, but also from a business continuity. And in the business continuity, one of the things they measure is innovation capability. And the first year we were benchmarked at 54th percentile globally. And in by the second year, we had moved up to the 98th percentile.
Wow.
So we learned a lot of lessons, made some good progress, but definitely that was a result of putting in place some kind of systems and learning and process along the way.
I mean, one of the things I'm hearing, which I'd love to hear more about, is sort of, I guess, those key ingredients, how you drove. I mean, you talk about the frustration of the various stakeholders. I mean, what are those key leadership characteristics that you saw coming up that helped you clear the path, create all that innovation capability?
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably describe it in terms of, I'm not sure these are leadership characteristics. If I think of leadership characteristics, resilience, and kind of having belief in your ideas, pushing through, empathy and being able to relate to your stakeholders and put yourselves in their shoes. And, an example of that is the business I'm leading now is a cannabis business. And when we first raised that at Molson Coors, there's a lot of emotion around that. And being able to listen and understand, empathize with all those perspectives was really key for us in being able to, to say convince others but bring others along the journey and help them see the vision that we saw for the potential business as well.
I mean, something you mentioned earlier about driving this sort of bold vision. I mean, how did you get, because that can often obviously bring people together. I mean, so how did it show up, I guess? A lot of the listeners are going, hey, if I could replicate what you're doing, how could I take that to my business? What does it look like to get multiple stakeholders to kind of go on the same journey to establish a vision? And did you see anything that really stood out as like, wow, those are amazing behaviors, characteristics that our executive team had, for example?
Yeah, I mean, if I guess start very way back at the beginning, I think one of the most important things that we did that enabled some success was being really clear about our goals. We looked at the kind of overall trajectory of the business, where the business wanted to be. And, from that, you're, basically able to determine what role does innovation need to play in the success of this business. So being explicit about what we were going to deliver to the business financially went a long way towards getting engagement and resources. It wasn't just a hobby, a side project. It was something that was going to deliver tangible results to the business. So that would be, I'd say, the first thing. Then the second thing was the pace and type of innovation and being really clear. And I think most organizations, or at least large ones, have this notion of horizon 1, 2, or 3, or some call it kind of renovation, sort of disruption.
Yep, exactly.
And I think once you've grounded yourself in the practical operating needs of the business, you realize that you cannot hit that goal, or at least we realized that we could not hit that goal just with renovation. They're absolutely, I mean, the number of new products, new flavors that are core brand, it was, you know, dozens and dozens. There's just no way to practically execute it. So that really opened the organization's eyes and our eyes to the fact that we needed to move into more disruptive initiatives that had much more material scale. And we ended up, you know, established the goal, look at what needs to be delivered on a short term versus medium to long term, and then allocate the resources between those. In our case, we call them horizon one, which is the near in immediate, and how much resource and time we were going to spend on the more disruptive. So that would be the second thing, Akiva. So be clear about the goals, kind of understand how you're going to get there against the different types of innovation. And then the third thing was being really clear about capabilities. And this was probably more of a learning journey, but certainly realized over time that the type of capability, mindset, resources required to deliver a true disruptive initiative is fundamentally different than delivering a new flavor on an existing brand. And that took us longer to figure out and put in place.
When you say longer, like what did that look like? You're talking months, talking a year?
I would say a year plus. And I would also say I'm not sure it's ever a journey that's complete.
Yeah.
And one of the most difficult things we had to overcome was mindset. And in a publicly traded company, appropriately, we're focused on quarterly results. And you know, delivering what our shareholders expect of us. At the same time, bringing in the mindset of that longer term, knowing that while short-term results are important, so is investing in the future and just helping our own team balance how we came to the business. So we're not just talking about disruption and ignoring the short-term needs, but nor are we just focused on the short-term and helping the entire organization get their head around that. Was a journey, and I think probably an ongoing journey for most organizations. It's not a right or wrong; it's a balance.
I mean, was there a specific element that helped you? Because lots of organizations try to do that, and they really fail at it.
Yeah. So
was there specific, like the executive was a key sponsor? I mean, was there something specific that you put in place that really helped you kind of achieve that?
I mean, sponsorship certainly helps. One of the things we did was bring in we call it an entrepreneur in residence, which again, I know a lot of large companies have started to do. But there was one particular initiative in the disruptive space that we were trying to bring to life. And like typical big company team that we were, we thought it out for 5 years. We knew exactly what it was going to require to get there. We knew it was going to cost us tens of millions of dollars. And you know, went to the executive team with our proposal and they said, no way. So we phoned up our entrepreneur in residence, or actually he was there in Denver with us, so spoke to him and said, listen, as a this individual, his name's Mike Stemple, he's done 20 plus startups, some have been wildly successful, many have failed. So we asked him, as an entrepreneur, how do you realize your vision and get the resources you need to get there? And his response was that he only worries about the next quarter. Yeah, he gets the funds for the next quarter and then he goes back to his stakeholders and raises more money. And it was this aha moment for us that just unlocked a completely different way of working. And what we implemented is still really important to have that vision and know where you're going. But we then just kind of broke it down into quarters and went back to the executive team and said, still believe in this. This is still where we're going. But we're only asking for $400,000 for the next quarter. And here's what we're going to come back and deliver to indicate that we're on the right path or we're not on the right path. And it was this incredibly liberating mechanism to help everyone kind of move past the barrier of mindset. But equally from an operations perspective, it also unlocked some pretty incredible things where we weren't committing any of our resources for more than a quarter. So if an idea didn't work out or we weren't getting the evidence we needed, we could shift those resources to another one. It just allowed us to be much more nimble as well.
Fascinating. It's fascinating to hear that, because I'd say that the quarter to quarter mentality is very much akin to the, you know, the lean startup methodology, which of course is, which is adopted from the startup world, which, you know, the circle is complete. And in the world that I've been doing with large corporate clients, whether it's through my Lugori Innovation business or the corporate entrepreneur community, you find the frustrations you're talking about. And I think one of the key pivots is the learning from, hey, let's quit trying to sell the mega project that's going to cost 10 million, 5 million, 20 million, because that's how big companies think, to let's adopt the startup mentality internally and go from there. So I think that was really, really, really cool learning. A side question I meant to ask you earlier, as part of the challenge here, did you have to redefine who your market was and who your customers was? And maybe my mindset is locked in what you used to do, but did you think of yourself as a beer company or a beverage company? Because I want to talk about your new journey and your new position, but you know, how did you get people's minds open? Did you have to like formally redefine what the marketplace was, or how did you do that?
I mean, first of all, very much define ourselves as a beverage company. And in fact, in the last, Molson Coors, I think in November, I got the timing slightly wrong, but changed their name from Molson Coors Brewing Company to Molson Coors Beverage Company, which was, I think, embedding the journey that we'd been on as a team. So pretty early on, I think there was an acknowledgement that we had a lot of capabilities that could move into other beverages. A lot of the non-alc beverages that were seeing explosive growth, kombucha, teas, cold brew coffee, all of those used similar production technologies to our installed base. So it was kind of born out of necessity, looking at the assets we had and, you know, how might we use those in a broader way, recognizing that we had core expertise around beverages in particular, distribution and otherwise. Mm-hmm. I'd say that shift wasn't as difficult. I think people pretty quickly got their head around that.
That's good. That's good. So, all right, fantastic. So a big shift, I guess, going from a brewing company to a beverage company lets you do things like CPD beverages. How did you get into it? Give us a little bit of the history. I guess it's technically a joint venture, but
yeah,
you know, what was the journey to get into that, and what led you to this current position? Then I'd love to hear about how you're going to disrupt the marketplace by being a leader in CBD beverages.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I didn't mention that in my introduction. So I'm currently leading a company called Tress Beverages, which is a cannabis-infused beverage business. So all non-alcoholic beverages infused with, you know, any number of cannabinoids from CBD to THC to combination, and continuing to explore others. We are operating only in federally legal markets, which for the moment is only in Canada. That's the scope of where we're focused. And it was a personal passion project for me. And pretty early on when I started the role leading innovation for Molson Coors, there was a lot of evidence that cannabis was going to disrupt alcohol in general and beer in particular. But it wasn't obvious how we might get into that business. And it was just through some kind of early exploration discussion with other entrepreneurs that we were able to come across a compelling business idea and business model around cannabis infused beverages, which of course capitalized on the core skill set and expertise of a Molson Coors, but also had a lot of gaps around know-how and cannabis production, and that's where we decided we needed to go look for a partner. But it was a long, long journey to launch a business, feel really proud of the work the team did, and equally the support of the executives at Molson Coors and Hexo, our cannabis partner, and the board. It was really impressive to see how people got behind it. And here we are today with a well-capitalized business about to launch our first set of cannabis beverages.
It sounds like a little bit of the Wild West right now in that space. And how do you blend the fact that you're in effect a startup, but you're capitalized by a large multinational, how do you play the best of both to try and, you know, come out as a winner? I mean, it's a highly innovative and disruptive marketplace. And, you know, again, to me, as an outsider, it doesn't seem like there are any clear winners yet. How are you going to try and make sure you are one of those winners?
It's a great question. I mean, the first thing I'd say is commitment to amazing products, commitment to educating consumers in the marketplace around responsible use. And the third thing would be creating a business that operates a little bit differently. And maybe I can take each of those and just kind of expand on them a little bit. But on the first one around creating amazing products, we brought together two companies, each with their own expertise, Hexo in cannabis and Molson Coors in beverage. And we've built a world-class facility in a small Ontario town called Belleville, which is, you know, roughly halfway between Toronto and Montreal. And the expertise that we were able to bring to that to create just amazing beverages, from formulation to the quality checks to making sure there's no oxygen, which will lead to the, you know, off notes in the package. I mean, we just couldn't have done it without the expertise of both partners. So, and we invested considerably behind being able to realize that vision. So I think that is one that certainly differentiates us. On the second one around responsible use, I do believe that, you know, certainly this is I believe in it fundamentally from a values perspective, promoting responsible use. If I'm more mercenary about it, I look at the alcohol business, and that's a really important part of how that business manages itself, is being clear and responsible around its product. So at Trust, we're launching, unlike some of the beverages, cannabis beverages you might find in the U.S. that are 100 milligrams of THC for a little 500 ml bottle, we'll be somewhere between 2.5 milligrams and 10 milligrams for single serve. And
big difference.
Really, really important mandate from our shareholders and that we hold kind of really closely as part of our core mission is products that you can sample, you can feel the onset really quickly, so you can kind of self-manage how much you're consuming, the right levels for you, and then equally investing parts of our profit in education and communication to the community at large. And then the third thing around a different kind of business, this is probably the most tricky. One of my observations in working for a large company in innovation is that I just believe fundamentally that the entrepreneur ecosystem is better set up in today's world to deliver truly breakthrough products. And a simple example I'd give of that is craft beer. I think it's well known, at least, well, around the world, but certainly North America, that they captured a disproportionate share over a decade or more. And I believe fundamentally part of that was the ecosystem they had. So you've got a bunch of craft brewers brewing beer in the back. They bring it out to the front. They put it in front of their customers. They try it. They like it. They make some more. They don't like it, they never make it again. But that product to feedback loop and continuous adjustment was so fast, allowed them, I believe, to hone in on what consumers wanted much more quickly than the typical packaged goods, which is, you know, put something out there, do a lot of focus groups. You know, by the time you get something to market, the opportunity may have passed. And then you put a whole bunch of money, distribution, and otherwise behind it that may or may not work. And so I think as I think about Trust, part of what we're really working to implement is how can we create a different kind of product development cycle, product launch cycle, that's, you know, lower cost, allows us to test and learn, create communities of drinkers and customers that can give us feedback that we can continuously improve. Because this is new to the world, and I mean, there are no illusions that we're going to get it perfect in the first go around. And so, to answer that question of what are we doing to set ourselves up to make ourselves different, is build a company that is continuously learning, iterating, and moving faster than our competitors.
How you got that tension right between large corporate and that, you know, fast moving innovation, you know, entrepreneurial ecosystem. I mean, a lot of us have tried that, and it's a hard task. I mean, just love to hear what are some of the key learnings? I mean, you said it was a long journey. What are some of the key learnings that you look back now in hindsight and go, wow, I wish somebody had told me these three things, right? Because you know, that would have been seriously helpful.
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, I can't say we've got it right yet. I mean, I'm seeing more of an intent than kind of actual accomplishment. So, I mean, I think part of, I'm not sure if I kind of look back, and it's probably more on things that have gone well so far. I think one of the things large companies do really well are controls and you know, financial controls or otherwise. And in an industry that's as heavily regulated as cannabis beverages, we absolutely brought that from our large shareholders. And I think that gave us a leg up versus some of our competitors around that discipline. So in a way, I guess that kind of, that foundation is more solid to build upon. And that allows us to take more risks at the front end of the business. I guess a second thing I would say, which is not something we've executed yet, but trying to find a way that replicates the entrepreneurial ecosystem more than the big company. So I think one of the risks that we still face as a business, most of the people at Trusser come from larger companies, that we kind of default back to the focus groups. And you know, so us building a connection to incubators or venture capitalists, or just building a really strong connection to that entrepreneurial community, looking for key companies that we can, or entrepreneurs we can invest in or with, that's something that's working in front of us. But I'm really clear that will be part of our success model.
I mean, just one little question on that is, I mean, how are you getting that right in terms of being, so to speak, the outsiders and not being pushed out of the system, right? Because you're in a big system. So how have you managed to keep organically connected that they haven't just rejected you as an organism?
Well, again, I'm speaking about future intent versus actual. So they may reject us yet. I don't know. But what we are striving to get the balance right, I really believe in founder-led businesses. And I think one of the things that we want to do is ensure that the founders of any business that we partner with continue to have a really strong role and voice and ability to see through their vision. And in a lot of ways, we're just there to provide advice or as required and capital to help them realize the vision. And I think, you know, putting in place kind of clear thresholds around, you know, when we might invest at various stages of their business so that everyone's clear on that will be important. But mostly it's just recognizing our role in supporting entrepreneurs achieving their vision.
If I could kind of summarize some of the fantastic things I heard. First is congratulations on moving the maturity level of innovation in corporate Molson Coors when you're in the innovation role from, I think you said you're at a 54% up to a 98% in terms of how far you got the company on the innovation scale. That's fantastic. And the lessons I took to do that were, you said you got to have clear goals. Among the clear goals, you needed to have obviously some financial goals. You needed to talk about the types of innovation you were going to do and the pace on those innovations, but then how it was really important to get the capabilities down. And of course, you know, music to my ears from working with Eric Reese in the corporate entrepreneur community is the idea of thinking more like a startup. You talked about an entrepreneur residence, which is something I always advocate clients do, to get someone like that. And think about almost like metered investments. You know, you talked about a quarter at a time. I mean, a venture capital fund, or, they're going to give you so much money till you get to the next tranche. What are you going to give us? And then go forward and do that. So really, really great learning. To me, one of the key, I would say to you, great success things is, I'm sure you were part of Molson Coors changing their name from Molson Coors Brewing to Molson Coors Beverage Company, which obviously represents a great vision and what they're doing. And then if I had to summarize what I heard about your JV at Trust Beverage, I'm just fascinated by combining the big company and the small company, the expertise you talked about, the responsible use, which personally, big hats off for me. I've always been someone who's very, very committed to responsible marketing and products and everything like that. And I think that's another trait of people who join the corporate entrepreneur community. But again, the top one on top of that is trying to understand how startups work and trying to be more entrepreneurial, more startup-like. I remember you were kind enough to help us out on a panel, I believe going all the way back to August last year at the Moody's in New York City. And we talked about, you know, do you work, you know, are you going to do innovation inside of a corporation? You're going to do it with startups, or are you going to do something? I think we kind of quasi-termed it a hybrid model, where you're going to go try and be a startup as you can, which is exactly what you're doing, but you've got backing by a corporate partner. I think that's really, really fascinating to do. And, you know, at the end of the day, giving found, you know, people who are founders, you can do founders in the sense that you're doing it and supporting them and encouraging them. And the idea of how craft brewing, you know, has always been on the cutting edge. Why? Because you make it in the back room and you bring it right out to the front room and you give it to your customers. I don't know how large corporations lost that connection to customers, but boy, they sure did. So hopefully they're going to get it back. So anyway, I think this was really, really, really insightful. I do hope we can have you back again. I want to wish you continued good success in your role. I'd like to tell folks who would be looking for more of these podcasts, you can certainly go look us up on Apple iTunes under You've Been Disrupted.
So come join the movement. Find us at bit.ly/disrupted today.